And but it joining us right now in the studio is Tim Cochran, who is going to be giving a presentation tomorrow night at the North House Folk School entitled The Dawn of Graham Ray, the American Fur Company on the Harbor in 1823 and 1825. Good evening, Tim.
Good evening.
How are you tonight?
I'm great, thank you.
Good, good to see you. And it's just a beautiful time on the shore, it seems like. Huh?
It's a great time of the year to be out, isn't it, Tim?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right.
Without gloves on.
Without gloves on. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about your presentation coming up tomorrow, The Dawn of Graham Ray, and something that's pretty interesting, I think, to everybody about how Graham Ray started. And, you say it's the American Fur Company that was on the harbor in 1823 and 1825. And I guess to give people some background on it, is that... what type of settlement are we talking in that type of years? I mean, what was happening in 1823 in Graham Ray?
Well, Graham Ray was basically wild. Nobody owned it. People weren't sure where it was. There was no European Americans here at the time. And what was really happening is this part of the world was basically a battleground between two fur companies, the American Fur Company, which was the upstart company owned by Astor, John Jacob Astor, became the richest man in the world at the time. And he was tangling with the old Hudson Bay Company, who was still at Fort William. And at this time, the border was uncertain. The allegiance of various people were uncertain, and in the middle of this, someone's trying to make a dollar as well. So
right. So tell us a little bit about, first of all, like, how did you get interested in this particular historical period? What brought you to, to that, way back when, early Graham Ray?
I blundered into both clerks' manuscript. There was two clerks that were here, the fall of 23 to the spring of 24, and then a second clerk from the fall of 24 to the spring of 25. In both cases, I was looking for other things and blundered into it. The second document, for example, is from the Library of Congress, and it's in the Henry Schoolcraft papers, which are huge. There's lots of them. And I was looking for Grand Portage-related things, and I blundered into this. So it was serendipity or luck.
Right, that you just rolled across that.
But. Yeah, and then it gets interesting enough that I get stuck, Matthew. It chooses you more than you choose it.
Right. So,
Did the clerks come at different times during that time period then? Were they...
Yeah, and a little bit more about that is that... just a few years prior to this period, the Hudson Bay Company still had a post in Fond du Lac. So for the 18 teens, there was hundreds of people streaming by that were British company men.
Sure.
But they'd be zipping by Graham Ray, and they'd be going to Fond du Lac and then inland. So that's actually when the first references to Graham Ray show up. They're paddling either, up or down, whichever you're looking for. And guess what? If you're in a canoe, Matthew, you would know this, and you're looking in semi-rough water, not too many choices.
Right. Sure.
Graham Ray would look very good.
It's very inviting.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I guess, going through things, it says in here that you... what you would call mind benders you found in the journals. And what are you talking about when you're talking about some mind benders?
Well, there's a few of them. One of them, which I would solicit anybody who's listening to help me with, because I don't have answers to mind benders.
Sure.
The first one is earthquakes. Okay, let me just read you a...
Should we be under the table?
I'm going to read you something from Bella Chapman. That was the first clerk's. And this is December 24th, 1823. And he's somewhere in Graham Ray Harbor. That's another question. And he says to his bosses, he's writing to his bosses, and I'll quote him here. We have had two earthquakes since winter commenced, and we shall shortly have a third or some other phenomena which will make its appearance. So I bid you goodbye, Bella Chapman. That's, and a few weeks later, I won't read it, but what he calls a third earthquake occurs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not an earthquake expert,
right. Sure.
But you get on the web, you start reading, you email, you torture experts, you know, they mm-hmm. think you're crazy. I'm pretty sure that it's unlikely that there was an earthquake here at that time.
Sure.
So if you buy that, then the question is, what was it?
Mm-hmm. What was the event that he was talking about?
What was an earthquake-like event that would make, that shake the ground, mm-hmm. cause the noise, do mm-hmm. all that?
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing to throw into the mind bender is these are guys that lived outside their whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not, this is not ice booming in the harbor. They've been around that.
Right, they've heard that type
they've
of
heard
stuff.
That.
Sure,
this is something out of the ordinary that somehow Bella Chapman equates as an earthquake, and he's not an unlettered guy. As in fact, he goes on to be one of the first legislators in the state of Michigan.
Hmm.
Has a pretty distinguished. So he's not. Mm-hmm. He's not
uneducated
just,
and just
sure, just off the cuff.
Yeah,
it's not off the cuff. So so mindbender one, what was it?
Sure, what it takes.
So your mind benders are you almost or anybody else have to kind of play detective a couple hundred years later and try to figure out what he was saying, and then going into other journals and comparing things and trying to solve that
and solve that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
That takes me into other kinds of.
And like you said, as you're looking for the answer to that, you might run into
another piece.
Another mind bender.
Well, usually they don't give up the answer really easy either, and sometimes you don't. Another mind bender in the sense of unexpected things is the workforce that was here. The American Fur Company was sending men primarily from Fond du Lac, from Duluth up here, and they were sending men all over, actually. So, and little old, coming up the North Shore, They were sort of like prospecting in a way on what the economic return might be in furs. And so it's an experiment. They're also, again, trying to compete with a Hudson Bay Company. So they send a very young but experienced clerk, two clerks, both of them very talented, as it turns out. But their main workforce surprised me, particularly what I think of Graham Murray, and that is that there was three Bonga brothers, and George, who had a very distinguished career, he became an interpreter. He ended up in Leech Lake. He's supposed to have carried something between 600 and 700 pounds across the Dalles Portage at Fond du Lac.
Wow.
But George Bonga was half African-American and half Ojibwa. So the first workforce here at Graham Murray, and the guy that stayed here the longest, was African-American and Ojibwa.
Well, now that's pretty interesting.
I was not what I would have guessed.
No, that's
right. That's not where I would have thought either.
Yeah.
That doesn't, that's very interesting. Huh. And wow, you must have just uncovered lots of things like that.
Are you finding, Tim, that a lot of people are coming, as you get information gathered and you start and you're on the radio and other talk presentations that you're having, do you find a number of people calling you or coming to you with information, historical pieces that they may have known or maybe have been passed down through generations that they might enhance what you're doing?
Normally, Dale, I would look for that if it was a little later.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with this is that it's so early.
Sure.
You know, this is really 30 years before the 1854 treaty in which this land, you know, was ceded by Ojibwa to, and then there's no continuity between these folks.
Right.
So,
there really isn't any information
in this case.
In that
there probably isn't that much oral tradition. It'd be great if there was, but I don't know of any.
What were some of the shortcomings that that they experienced? It looks like the AFC didn't last or do a lot in the area at that time. What was it that they didn't like?
Well, there's two sides to this. So, and we've talked a little bit about the trader side, but there's the Ojibwa side of this as well. And that's mostly where the answer comes from to your question. So you're in a Ojibwa family, you're living on the North Shore. You've been trading with Hudson Bay Company for years.
Sure.
And then these strangers show up.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly they're slick talking.
Oh, sure.
Americans that, you know, are saying, you know, we'll be your buddies, we'll be sticking around.
We're better than they are.
We got better products is the case. We got better knives.
Sure.
We got better woolens. We got better. And they're, you know, they're going to stay here and live here. And they don't know if you're going to come back.
Oh, right.
They have a business deal. They have a relationship with Hudson Bay Company. And they couldn't, in the case of what happens in these 2 year periods, they couldn't really budge that.
Sure.
On the other hand, the Ojibwa wanted them here because then all of a sudden they had competition.
Sure.
So the Ojibwa role was you have to be, you have to keep that, you want the American Fur Company coming back, but you're hedging your bets that they won't come back. so they're playing this role too.
Oh, sure.
And so far, Hudson Bay Company has been, you know, they've been there every year. They've taken care of you maybe on occasion if you've been sick and you have a relationship with them. You know, this is also the time period where Americans are not really that, they're not knights in shining armor in this part of the world.
Sure.
You know, the 1812 war was just finished, and most Ojibwa sided with the British in that war. So remember, the Americans are settling. They're taking land, which is not a great thing from an Indian perspective. The HBC, that the British traders, don't want to take land yet, so they look in that.
They look really good.
They look better, yeah.
And was that the American Fur Company listed, you know, on the harbor in 1823 and 25? Was that the start of Grand Marais? Was there things here before that you found? Was there any type of community or any type of settlement?
Well, I think there was Ojibwa encampments, not big ones. Again, one of the reasons that Grand Marais is probably as pretty and as pristine as it is from a biological angle, if you have to eat from the resources here, it's pretty relatively sterile to other places. I mean, there's not, we think of a lot of deer now, but that's all because the forests have been cut. At that time, there were no deer here. There's a few moose and more caribou. I mean, that's what they were hunting.
And farmland's not so great.
No, farmland's not so great. So big settlements, unlikely. Ojibwa encampments, because fishing was pretty good here and is good here. Yes. Euro-American settlements, I really highly doubt it. This is... there's every other year the American Fur Company would show up in this part of the world, usually kind of in a traveling kind of enterprise. In this case, they built cabins. They tried to make a go of it here and failed pretty well.
Right. So from that point on, was there always from 1825 and onward, has there pretty much been a settlement there?
Well, the American Fur Company would... Actually, they learned a number of lessons here. They would spend more time in Portage, in Grand Portage, than down here. You would go where the Ojibwa were rather than have them come to you.
That was more of the hub that right was, up there.
Right. So, no, not continuous settlement. I think people passed through. And, you know, literally it was illegal to be here to some degree unless you had a trading license. So
was that something that was pretty hard to come by?
Fairly hard. I mean, you had, I think more going through the steps and then proving that you had the money and the reason to be doing that. So you had to apply to the Indian agent at the Sioux to come up here.
Right. So the clerks themselves, then, did they spend 1 year each up here, the two that you're talking about?
Succession? Right. Bella Chapman was here first. He had a kind of a second in command named Ambrose Davenport. Amazing family. His Ambrose Davenport's dad was one of the Americans that refused to bow to the British when they took over Michilimackinac Island and was almost killed for that. Pretty distinguished. Matthew, he was a fiddle player. He was so I can imagine there was some music being played.
Oh, I bet that. Yeah.
His first child was born here. Reuben Chapman was born somewhere down there in the harbor.
Yeah.
That's Mindbender number 4 is exactly where it was.
There you go.
Yeah, so these guys all have personalities and mm-hmm. strengths and weaknesses, just like all of us. And mm-hmm. that's trying to bring all that, you know, to the fore so you can get a sense of it.
Mm-hmm. And it's about 16 minutes past the hour 6 here on the Roadhouse, and we're visiting with Tim Cochran, a local historian who's going to be giving a presentation tomorrow night at the North House Folk School at 7 p.m. called The Dawn of Grand Marais, the America Fur Company on the Harbor in 1823 and 1825, and that starts at 7 o'clock. And doing research on the area and surrounding areas is nothing new to you, because I know you did, forgive me for not knowing the exact name of the book, though, but you did a book up in the Isle Royale area, is that correct?
Right,
and yep. So you're kind of into the research is a good thing, and this might turn into a book itself, this idea of these 2 years?
Yeah, that's what I envision, yeah. Okay. It keeps me out of trouble, man.
We like that. It's good. We don't want you running around getting into trouble here in Grand Marais.
That's right.
First thing, it's too cold.
You don't want to follow Matthew's footsteps.
That's right.
Well, it sounds like you have some excerpts from your journal. And did you want to share some of those with us?
Let me read just one other one. This one is from the second clerk, mm-hmm. Whose name was George Johnston. Mm-hmm. And he is a brother-in-law to Henry Schoolcraft. And actually, he did a number of things for Schoolcraft that showed up in Schoolcraft's books. So anyway, he was here. He really didn't like it. I mean, the more mm-hmm. you read in his journal, the more he does not like Grand Marais. Mm-hmm. But I thought I'd read just his first day in Grand Marais to give you a sense. And again, they're writing back to their bosses. This is Grand Marais, September 11th, 1824. My dear friend, once more I will trouble you with my nonsense. I arrived here this morning. It's lonely and dismal place it is by the very first appearance. The bay is semicircular, and by observing it from the lake, resembles very much a horseshoe. The beach is gravelly, the main shore is perpendicular rocks. It would be a good harbor for 2 or 3 vessels at a time on utmost emergencies, and one between Fond du Lac and Grand Portage. See, I'll skip a little. The growth of timber is spruce, a few stunted pines, poplar, white birch, cedars, and at some distance into the interior here and there a cluster of maple. The appearance of the country in general is sterile. In fact, I cannot but lament my situation, considering that I have nearly 10 months to remain this, I may safely say, Siberian exile. No one to converse with but ignorant Canadians and the natives. Thus, I must desist troubling you any further on such lame subjects, as I must accordingly to promise you write you a copy of my journal. And much ado, George Johnston.
So, George, what were his interests that, do you think, of course, when you come up here, I'm sure at that time, with it being pretty well forested and all the rock formations and not a lot of farmland that a lot of these people were used to, it's not as if they were going to go out and ride a horse or put out their vegetables or do gardening or some of the things that they might be used to sustain or to supplement some of what they're taking place too.
Yeah, he's young. He's mm-hmm. trying to prove himself to his bosses. I mean, the real goal is to, you know, bring back some important furs, some valuable furs. Mm-hmm. He knows he's failing. Well, not here, but later on he knows that he's failing at that. But he also, went to school in Montreal, very well schooled. He read a lot of books while he was here. He makes note when he runs out of books, because that's not a good day when he runs out of them.
Sure.
I think both of them were ambitious men, and they realized that this is not a place where I'm going to make my name, you know, in the company. Mm-hmm. And so they want to get it over with. Get me to another spot as soon as you can.
That was my question. In the 1820s, was it viewed as, you know, if you're a young kid or even an older person, were you being sent to Siberia type of thing? Was it a bad thing to be sent to Grand Marais? Like, that's a bad spot to go. We don't know what's there. Was it, you know, like now you see people, oh, I got sent to Siberia.
I'm going to go to the North Pole.
I'm going to send you somewhere you don't want to go, you know, because you're a bad person or you're a bad employee. I'm going to send you to Siberia rather than send you down to, say,
hot
you know,
springs.
Palm Springs, or the hot springs, or somewhere nice. I mean, was this a coveted position for somebody, or was this an outpost?
Well, I think it was more of an experiment. They didn't know. And all along the Minnesota-Ontario border, they were, the American Fur Company was clashing with the Hudson Bay Company. So they mm-hmm. wanted to get their men up there, mm-hmm. and they basically, fur trade companies and the U.S. government were not one and the same, but very, there's a lot of connections there. So they were interested in establishing where the border was and to see if they could make some money. I mean, think of this. I mean, Grand Portage used to be the headquarters of this, the mm-hmm. largest fur trade emporium in North America. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't you be able to turn a buck
oh, right.
in this part of the world?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
as it turns out, Grand Portage was more of a trade
crossroad of some
crossroads mm-hmm. than mm-hmm. an actual collection mm-hmm. place.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to rediscover that the hard way, I mm-hmm. guess.
All right.
I think that's probably true with a lot of when you have monopoly situations is that somebody outside looking in is thinking, boy, there must be a lot of money going through that place or a lot of opportunity until they actually get there and find out what the situation is.
It's kind of hard to think of Graham Ray starting as a monopoly, but you're right.
It is.
I mean, this is the biggest company in the U.S.
coming here
and giving it a shot.
Absolutely.
It's not a little mom-and-pop.
Right. Yeah, it's not a fly-by-night piece.
No.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for coming in. Tomorrow night, 7 o'clock at the North House. It's a free presentation. If you want more information, you can give them a call down there at 387-9762. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, guys.